Welcome to Off the Page. It's great to be with you. I wanted to begin this episode by sharing something we're really excited about here at Franciscan Media. So starting with this episode, we're going to begin implementing segments throughout the podcast that invite you to pause and consider what a guest has said. So probably won't do this every episode, but many will include these segments, beginning with this one. So our friends at the Center for Action and Contemplation, they call these contemplative sits. I really like that as an invitation. My dear friend and mentor, the late Father Dan Riley up at Mount Irenaeus, he called opportunities like this Franciscan Lectio, and he based that on the quadratic structure for prayer attributed to St. Clare of Assisi. That structure is simply this: gaze, consider, contemplate, and imitate. So in these times of pausing throughout the conversation, we're invited to take the words spoken by a guest, hold them in our hearts, gaze upon them, consider them, contemplate them, which is to say we simply let them sink deeper and deeper into our hearts, into our very being, and then ultimately imitate the truth that is being revealed to us. So why exactly implement a segment like this? It's really part of an overall movement at Franciscan Media called Rebuild God's Church, where we hope that our resources can better accompany you on your spiritual journey as we seek to hopefully meet you digitally, multimedia-wise, right where you are. And so maybe you do just want to listen to the interview without these Franciscan Lectio moments. That's perfectly fine. You can fast forward through these segments. But we do invite you into St. Clare of Assisi's movement of prayer as you listen, to not just consume information with the mind, as, to be honest, I so often do that when I listen to podcasts. It's all up here. It's all cerebral. But to truly listen with the ear of the heart. Gaze, consider, contemplate, imitate. I feel like this movement is so important in my own life. Because we're all really being invited into this rebuilding process, right? Into what it means to bring healing into our own lives, our own households, our own communities, and ultimately our world. So speaking of St. Clare, it's a joy to introduce to you our next guest, a world-renowned scholar on St. Clare of Assisi, Sister Margaret Carney. Sister Margaret is a member of the Sisters of St. Francis of Newman Communities. Her education in theology and Franciscan studies took place at Duquesne University, the Franciscan Institute of St. Bonaventure University, and she was the first woman to graduate from the Franciscan University of Rome at the doctoral level. Sister Margaret is a rock star. She provides tours for Franciscan pilgrimage programs. That's where she and I met, actually. And she is a board member at Franciscan Media. She was the president at St. Bonaventure University from 2004 to 2016. And her beautiful book, her biography on St. Clare, Light of Assisi, is available in the Franciscan Media store, Amazon, or wherever books are sold. The focus of today's conversation is about St. Clare's legacy and leadership being their own light to us as we navigate this fraught political moment and polarized age that has really been upon us for the last several years. I should say that this conversation was recorded 1 month after the 2024 election and a little over a month before the inauguration. So I found this to be such an important conversation, and I really hope you learn as much from Sister Margaret as I did. As you'll hear, though, Sister Margaret and I really dive right into Clare's life and impact. If you don't know much about St. Clare, that's okay. But if you do want to learn more, I cannot recommend Sister Margaret's book enough. And we also have numerous videos on St. Clare on our YouTube channel, many recorded by Sister Margaret herself. Or you can visit our website, franciscanmedia.org. And a little hint, click on the search finder in the top right corner, and you can simply type in, you can search anything you want. Type in Clare, and you'll see close to 100 pages of content, stories, all revolving around St. Clare of Assisi. So, without further ado, our interview.
S-
Sister Margaret Carney, thank you for joining Off the Page.
Good morning, Stephen. Glad to be here.
The kind of impetus for this podcast, for this episode, was a metaphor that St. Clair returns to quite often in her writings, this notion of a mirror. For example, this mirror of eternity that we're invited to gaze upon. And really the idea for this episode came from a conversation we had about turning this mirror on the life and legacy of St. Clair and seeing how it might help us to find our way amid the difficulties in our society, just some of the cultural challenges that we're all navigating right now. Did I summarize our idea for this episode okay, or do you have anything to add?
Yes, you do. The only thing I would like to add, Stephen, is that since our earliest planning and to today, we've had a very dramatic national experience with our most recent election. And so in talking about Clair as a mirror for facing the difficulties of your time, I don't want any of my remarks to be taken as a false equivalency. Our times are profoundly different in regard to culture, society, Christianity as a framework. However, the beauty of human history is that we learn in every generation that there are things that propel the human person to good or to evil or to the in-between, and that we can learn from those who went before us. And Clair has often not been seen as a person with a lot to tell us, in contrast to her friend and mentor, St. Francis, but we're uncovering year by year more of her as a model and a leader for us. So let's let her try to help us out in this interesting time we're living through.
Yeah. And thanks to people like you, you know, you're one of the few on the front lines that are helping to uncover that
right.
As a Clair scholar. So
thank you.
We're all very grateful for your work and your beautiful book. Got it right here. Yeah. Give you a quick little plug. How about that?
Thank you. Very good. Very good. Sister Nancy Solaski and I, who was my next door neighbor while I studied in Rome, we went off and did preliminary work on quite a few of the early Franciscan women, Margaret of Cortona, Angela, the two Angelas, etc. And our mantra was the women want their story told. So we're happy to be doing that.
Awesome. Well, let's dive right in. Like you said, we'll be kind of crossing that interpretive bridge today, trying to put Clair's life and legacy in its own historical context, which was 800 some years ago, but then also trying to apply what we may learn from her today as we navigate some of these things in our society. So to begin, what were some pillars from her life that could perhaps be helpful to us amid the challenges we're facing?
I think obviously the first came from how she learned from Francis to focus on Jesus as the poor, humble victim, the one who came to redeem us in his body, in his blood. And so she is in a state, religiously speaking, of constantly trying to find in the Gospels the stories, the instances where Jesus manifests mercy, compassion, understanding, non-judgment, but she sees that Jesus is a man of a certain time and place, but he is open to the Pharisee. He's open to the centurion. He's open to this woman who literally is almost a pagan. And I think that becomes a way for both of them to take a place in a society where certain social changes are happening and none too comfortably.
Can you go a little bit deeper into some of those social changes?
Yes. Clair lives at a moment that is really quite fascinating when you try to think about how the lot of women is changing in various cultures and times. So we tend to think, rightly so, of women in, for example, the ancient Rome, and that would be then the Italian peninsula as Roman influence takes over the whole land. Rome right up through about the 11th century, It's a very patriarchal society, and the woman is an asset. She's a daughter to be married off, either, you know, for a man with military power or land or political prestige. And that doesn't mean that fathers don't love their daughters. It just means that if you have daughters, they're a burden unless you can make those arrangements for them. What is changing that in a very interesting way is the fact that right in the time of Claire and Francis, 13th century, there is what is known as a surplus of marriageable women. Demographically, there are more women who are of marriageable age than there are men due to crusades, famine, what have you. So women are, in a sense, together and alone, looking for different ways to deal with their status that keeps them in dignity and even just keeps them economically. So you have a rise not only of women going into monasteries, but women creating little communities that don't have a big monastic footprint, but they come together, they pool their resources, they lead a Christian life, they serve the poor. It's a whole new thing. You also have the fact that women are now in the communes, in the cities, where trade is becoming as important as land ownership. Women whose families, whose husbands are involved in a trade, are either part of that family business, sometimes they run it because the husband is off on crusade or trading or dies early. So you have women who are entrepreneurs and have a great deal of freedom. They travel, they have money, they can pay people and hire people. That's a pretty new reality. And in the nobility, of which Claire is a part, the lower levels of nobility, and that would be where she is in the Ofreduccio clan, she's not a princess, she's not a duchess. These women are living on the margin of the women who come from the old Roman system. Father knows best. You will only do what father allows. Two, look at this. There are women finding new ways that, you know, it's not that the church doesn't like it. The church just didn't think of it and now tries to figure out how to regulate it. Economic success for women. But still, in those instances, women have no political voice. Their only voice is through the family, through the husband, through the son. So the successful partnerships in marriage will include the woman's voice, but it will always be hidden.
Yeah, it was amazing for me to be graced with opportunity to go on a Franciscan pilgrimage with you last year, and you're one of our leaders. And I'll always remember the night we did that Claire walk, the spiritual imagination of thinking of her leaving this place of nobility in the upper levels of Assisi and then running straight downward. And then eventually, I think the next day, or maybe it was that very day that we visited San Damiano in the community that she led. I'm always struck by that image of this leader, so bold, so radical. And then her leadership came out in the community that she helped lead as well.
That's right. Downward mobility is a big deal for Franciscans.
Can you go a little bit deeper into downward mobility
and
what that means?
Well, it's just what you described. Yeah. It's, you know, we usually speak of upward mobility as people socially being able to improve their lot, you know, get a better job, marry into the right level of society, find respect through work that you do, develop a reputation so that you're kind of always seen as moving higher, whether it's in your place of work, your family, your town, et cetera. But for the Franciscans, the idea was don't aspire to those higher types of awards for your achievement. Aspire to keep going down to where the poor are, where the neglected are, and learn from them where Jesus is present in the world. Not an easy lesson ever.
So I wanted to pause here early in this conversation to consider this notion that Sister Margaret brought up, something that I believe is uniquely Franciscan, and this idea of downward mobility. In Sister Margaret's book, Light of Assisi, she writes about this moment in Claire's life where she sneaks out of her house. It's almost straight out of a movie. And she, middle of the night, sneaks out of her house and she leaves this comfortable place of nobility and essentially runs straight downward, beyond the city walls toward the lower levels of Assisi where the poor resided. And it's there that she meets up with Francis and his brothers and officially begins her new life. So Sister Margaret writes on page 27 in her chapter, Midnight Exodus. Finally, Claire arrived at the tiny church of Santa Maria degli Angeli. Once there, she was formally received by Francis in a carefully orchestrated ritual. Her beautiful clothing was exchanged for a penitent's robe. Francis himself cut her hair, the time-honored tradition for women seeking to leave the world to live by religious vows. A simple veil marked her as given to Christ in a life of virginity. In the presence of the brothers, Claire professed her dedication to Jesus, and like them, to poverty and their simple rule. All that she once claimed as a member of a noble family was put aside, and all that she would become as a woman fixed on God would be accomplished in partnership with them. So, this scene, one, it's beautiful. Do we know exactly what happened? No, but it's a beautiful scene to contemplate. This midnight exodus of Claire and this running straight down almost becomes its own model for the spiritual trajectory of anyone, in my opinion, who's claiming to follow Christ. And this downward mobility, it really mirrors the incarnation, where God comes down and takes on the humble form of this human baby born into an oppressed people group. Really the radical self-giving kenosis of the Trinity pouring into creation and taking on a body, humbly taking on a body. And I find this idea of downward mobility really challenging and inspiring. I mean, there's such pressure and emphasis in our society to move upward. And not all of that is bad. I really don't think it is. But when, in my experience, when that upward climb becomes all-consuming, I think we not only lose perspective, but we also become disconnected from our hearts and the true self. Why is that? I think it's because the soul is inherently spiritually connected to God and others and creation around us. We're not meant to be isolated, self-absorbed. And communally, we're really kind of witnessing this right now. You know, when everything becomes all about climbing or profit or the bottom line or some kind of self-focused isolationism, there can be a disconnect from the common good and our own responsibility to be a force of good in this world. So what does downward mobility look like in one's own life? For me, time and again, it has looked like running downward toward what might be risky or uncomfortable, putting the heart on the line, confronting the ego, bringing insecurities to the surface, learning from the other, allowing the margins to be a pathway to my own continued conversion. And I love that for Claire, as she goes downward, ultimately the gospel expands for her. And I think that can be true for each of us. So I'll conclude this Franciscan Lectio section with this line from Sister Margaret's book. This is on page 26, the page before what I read earlier. And Sister Margaret writes, "Once on the other side of this gate, in Assisi's protective walls, Claire would become a citizen of another commune of gospel striving." Yeah, and that's what I was wondering. Do you see this as a potential void or pitfall in our society where this obsession with upward mobility, and what does that mean for our own spiritual trajectories today?
Well, Stephen, from my associations with colleges and their responsibility for the education, but also the human formation of young people, I am deeply, deeply concerned about the immediate future of younger generations because, let me say, and I'm no expert on the use of the social media, but I know enough and I've read enough to know, for example, you gain your reputation as a 13-year-old by how many likes you get. You may never leave your bedroom, but you create this artificial community. It's not artificial, it's real around yourself. And you look at the bright side and the dark side of those kinds of influences on young people and think, you're never going to preach a word of humility and not caring about your image. You know, it is going to take a real miracle of grace to bring the gospel to young people who've had no other coaching about a religious framework. Now, I'm not saying this is going to be true of all young people, but we know of the young people coming into Catholic colleges today, and this number may be lower now, 10% will have had an active practice of their faith. 10%. So young people come to a Catholic college because it's good, their parents are pleased with it, it has their major. They're not coming dying to learn their faith. And so we have to be crafty about bringing them along intellectually, spiritually, humanly, how we do that. But I do think trying to speak to this notion of stepping aside and taking a servant position. But I will say this, it is better caught than taught. So for example, when we will take students to a place where a disaster has happened, and they're helping flood victims, or, you know, they're post-pandemic, or so often that is the transformative experience because they see utter poverty, deprivation, things that could lead to hopelessness and despair. They arrive, and simply by helping somebody clean mud out of their basement, they're suddenly seen as like this messianic person. And as long as we conduct those experiences and provide reflection, an opportunity for students to dig deep into the emotions of that, what were you feeling? What are you thinking? Does it remind you of anything? Maybe something you've read in the gospel? That's what can light a fire. And so we need to also to be very attentive to that type of experience.
Well, those experiences are teaching through the praxis of lived experience.
Exactly.
You know, like downward mobility, right? And you used the word humility earlier, which is so big in the Franciscan tradition. But downward mobility in our culture, that's always the pressure that young people feel to climb, to achieve, to accomplish, to make something of your, and not that all that stuff is bad.
No, it isn't. No.
However, if it's done without humility or it's done without these experiences of downward mobility, I think we lose a big part, myself included. I think I miss out on a huge aspect of myself when I'm so focused on the next thing.
Yes.
And not allowing the humble God to animate my day-to-day life.
That is true, Stephen, but you made a really important point, which is we don't want to snuff out good ambition. You know, in other words, I think of the young person who wants to study law in order to be an advocate for the homeless or, you know, single parents. Well, here's news. You don't do really well academically, you're never going to get that law degree. So you have to have an ambition about doing well, passing the LSATs, passing your boards. So, you know, we don't want to make people feel guilty because they got a good grade or, you know, they were recognized by, you know, an organization or the dean or something like that. But it's keeping that balance is the thing. And that's where community helps. You know,
yeah.
If somebody reminds you, you know.
Yeah, and Claire was very ambitious in her own way, correct?
Exactly.
I mean, that kind of brings us back to Claire
yeah.
and her own spiritual journey.
That's right.
Can you go deeper into her own ambition and where it took her?
Yes, I would say her principal ambition is not Francis, it's Jesus. And she wants a life of following right behind Jesus so she can feel him, smell him, you know, his cloak flips back into her face in the wind, because she learned that from Francis. And she watches how Francis, year by year, grows in that and becomes courageous enough even to pray to share his suffering. So he's the mentor all the time, but it's always the two of them helping each other unravel this mystery of Christ. So I think that in that way, she is positioning herself with Francis as a guide. She also has other guides, though. We know, for example, that as they become more organized and the church takes more of an interest in, okay, are we going to approve these women or not? Are they just sort of out there, part renegade, part holy women? They assign Cistercian, we would say today Trappist monks, to come and preach to them because they are educated preachers. The friars, by and large, especially in the earliest years, did not have a university or scriptural education. And we know that Claire distinguished between the really good speakers and the ones that weren't so up to par. And so while she had no comparable education, she clearly had that kind of intuitive intelligence that can learn in amazing ways, even given a little bit of resource. So these Trappists, and you will remember Brother Concilio from California, the Trappist monk who joined us for a while in Rome. He's a great example of a Trappist who's been able to bring his musical talent out to the service of our community of Mount Irenaeus. But that was a big thing for her. And I also, certainly among the friars, there were friars with different talents, wisdom, insight after the death of Francis that were very close to her and remained close with her right through to her death. And I think she learned, I know, she learned from church leaders like Cardinal Ugolino, and who then becomes Pope Gregory the Ninth. She doesn't just, sort of allow them to come in and speak and then, like, oh, well, you know, they'll do their thing, we'll do ours. She hears, she listens, she knows what the concerns are. So she allows herself, I think, and the bishops of Assisi. It's a little confusing because for the whole time of life of Francis and Claire, the bishop was called Guido. So sometimes we're talking about Guido I, Guido II. But she allowed herself to be schooled.
How did Claire, in her time, where, like you said, a very patriarchal society, how did she manage relationships with diverse officials among the friars and then within the church as well, as you've been mentioning?
Well, I think this is just a bit of a postscript to that last response, Stephen. And I think part of the way she was able to do that is she is one of those people who has a very particular talent for adjusting to the person, the culture, the frameworks for discussion of the person she is with. That is not a talent that is equally distributed in the human race. There's some people who it's like, you know, it's their way or the highway, or they only have one way of looking at an issue. Claire, and this is something here again, you can learn it, but I think it's also innate in certain people. So she understood the patterns and the protocols and the courtesies of the nobility. So if a cardinal comes calling at San Damiano, he will be received as a noble guest. She also understood the plight and the worries of the servants in the house. You know, she clearly knew them. She was attentive to what was going among the poor in Assisi. We have the stories of her sending food to the poor through her servants. So she clearly had that ability. And the person in our world that also manifests that today is Pope Francis. I heard a wonderful statement yesterday by Gerard O'Connell, a Vatican journalist, who said, Pope Francis is not saying anything different in principle about the economy, the greed of the ultra-rich, the danger to the environment. He said, Benedict said it. John Paul II said it. But Francis uses language ordinary people relate to. And now people are like, did you hear what the Pope said? Well, guess what? It's been said for 25 years. But that's how he disrupts things, because he will use a turn of phrase that you're like, Pope Francis said that, you know? He doesn't speak Vaticanese. He speaks the language of people. And so I think he's a good example in our time of someone with his vast Jesuit education who can relate to the highest levels of authority, but sit with a farmer or a sick child, you know, or a struggling parent and get right in there with them.
Yeah, that notion of authority is very interesting, because Claire herself seemed like she was certainly radical in her own way, in her own mm-hmm. spiritual journey, and a bit of a disruptor as well. And yet she had a respect for authority as well. She had a respect for institutions, which, not to project too much on our own culture today, but we're navigating a time where people have an intense distrust, sometimes for good reason, but there's this really intense and growing distrust of our institutions, to the point that to be radical or a disruptor, it becomes less humble, less compassionate, more certain. Do you know where I'm going with that kind of?
Yes. I think you've hit on a really important cultural dilemma for us, Stephen. That mistrust of institutions, I think, may be one of the most insidious problems that is going to either, if we don't find a way to bring in a corrective, is going to really cripple us as a democracy. As a younger person working in diocesan administration, I was blessed to work with a couple of really superb this was a new thing in the church, to have people pay attention to organizational design, organizational planning, how to evaluate and assess whether the organization was a parish council, which was a new thing post-Vatican, or a diocese, or a hospital or college. And so in those years, I learned to think about the power of institutions, but also to think about what does it take to maintain an institution that is worthy of trust. And if you're doing that job, you never sleep. So the more complex, the more institution, the more you've got to have eyes on a lot of different things. But I don't think we talk about them. We say, oh yeah, the institution's impoverished and oppressed. Tell me about this. Tell me about the Catholic hospitals that literally give millions in unrefunded care every year in their emergency room because the sister sponsors or the Catholic sponsors have made that a condition of budgeting in that hospital. That is not an institution that's doing harm. Now, there may be parts of the institution. Maybe there are certain workers not getting compensated as they should, or maybe over here there's a department where there's a lot of toxic stuff going on. But the point is, if you give up all institutional power, you reduce your work to one by one by one by one. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying in a culture as complex as that of the United States of America, you need both. And sadly, I think in the excitement of the late 60s and 70s when we were being liberated from oppressive institutions, a lot of this coming from liberation theology in Latin America, which got transposed sometimes uncritically to the United States, we pulled back from dedicating ourselves to the good of institutions. And the church is paying a price for that now.
Yeah, and I'd be curious, too, to learn from you about perhaps some instances where Claire rejects or resists accepting directions from authorities.
Sure.
And then also times when she accepts policies, practices that are requested or required by church officials, because she had a very brilliant dance with all of these authorities, correct? Yeah.
That's a dance is a good word to describe it. The first authority she went mano a mano with was Francis. Remember, she was undertaking a really vigorous fast, and it was clearly endangering her health. And Francis must have come to ask her to, you know, give this up. I'm sure the sisters were frantic and probably asked him to intervene. She did not listen, and he went and brought the bishop. I mean, you don't bring the bishop into a monastery for that conversation lightly. And it says to me that to that point, she had refused the advice. And he was saying, what am I going to do? You know? And it's even one of the mysteries of who she was, that she could be so near with herself that even Francis couldn't reach her at times. So that's the first. Second, and there was another instance where he brought five young women to the monastery after he'd come back from preaching in certain towns. And there was one young lady, she said to him right from the get-go, this is not going to work. He said, oh, lovely family, the pastor thinks she's great, you know, whatever. So she agrees to give it a try, but she was right, he was wrong. This young woman didn't last very long. So, you know, she maintained her own judgment. The really big and lengthy contest she had was with Cardinal Ugolino, who was appointed to serve as a kind of ombuds or liaison between the Curia in Rome and all these new communities of women. Let it be said first, Ugolino admired her, had enormous affection, was so impressed. But his job was get them all into shape. Here's the rule you give them. Here are the directions they have to follow. They want our approval. This is what you do. You don't do this, you don't get our approval. And in fact, we can close that monastery. We can tell a bishop, you go in there, tell those ladies to go home, take the keys, lock the door. And it was done in certain places. So with Ugolino, she had someone who wanted her to succeed, but was convinced she could only succeed if she accepted, this is what Rome is asking you to do. So what we see in her interactions with him during the lifetime of Francis and after the lifetime of Francis is a protracted debate about, can they truly live without any property? Because he, as any church official, any male of the time, if a woman did not have the title in marriage or the title through being a daughter or sister to a powerful brother, she had to have property of some sort not to starve. And if women went into monasteries, they took their endowments with them. And then these rich families kept giving to monasteries so that the women were kept up. Claire is like, none of that. And they're saying, this will not work. And she's saying, watch me. And so poor Ugolino, I mean, I do feel sorry for him. You know, it's like, he has to keep going back and saying to the Pope, mission not accomplished. She's holding out.
Yep.
And then finally, it's when Agnes in Prague, the very wealthy woman, comes and has all of these, oh my God, really property, rights, titles. And she wants to follow this way. Oh, poor Now he's the Pope, and he's insisting that Agnes follow. And Claire writes that famous line, "What you hold, may you always hold. No matter what anyone tells you, do not abandon." And of course, it took us years to figure out that anyone was the Pope.
That's great.
Code. You know who I'm talking about. Well, Agnes, yeah, of course, had the great advantage that her brother was a king. And her brother appealed on her behalf to the Pope. So there's a political triangle there that worked on their behalf. Had that not been the case, I don't think Agnes could have held out.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you just brought up several situations there where Claire's engaged in this dance. You know, she has resolve, but also respect. She has ambition, but also humility. She, like you said, watch me. Like she knows what she wants, and yet she does it in such a humble way.
Right. And I didn't answer the second part. Are there times when she accepts a regulation that would not be to her liking? So I'll give you an actual example. Claire did not write out her rule of life until she was close to death. So 5 years before her death, she begins that work. In the meantime, from the year 1217, Francis is still alive. She's being given rules, first by Ugolino and other directives from the papacy, and then a rule from Pope Innocent IV, which is the last to come from Rome to her. And they have very, very strict instructions for the women on everything, when they fast, what they wear. But the big one is the enclosure, how they are in these enclosed monasteries, locks and keys for the main door, always, you know, two sisters at the entrance. No men entering unless they have a companion with them, like workmen or friars. And you're like, oh, my God. Now, I would have to say that's the kind of bad law that arises from crises. Yeah, something, there's something being corrected here, but it's overcorrecting. So I'll give you this example. When in one of the final rules, the rule of Innocent IV, they talk about, can you leave the monastery, okay? This is the way that is described. And it's described as soon as a woman enters and becomes a novice. Once they have observed this rule, they may never be granted any permission to leave this enclosure unless perhaps they are transferred to another place. So you only leave here if you go to another monastery. Or to reform a monastery, and they can at times be transferred for pious reasons, but as a general rule, only with permission of the general, that means of the friars. However, it is fitting that when they die, both the enclosed as well as the serving sisters are buried there. So you never leave. Now, when you get to that statement for Claire, she says, I love this because it starts with how your hair is to be cut. After her hair has been cut all round and her secular clothes set aside, she is allowed to have three tunics and a mantle. And thereafter, she may not go outside the monastery except, listen to this, for a useful, reasonable, evident, and justifiable purpose. That's a very different way to look at what allows me to leave this enclosure. Now, today, you will find many Clarian monasteries. There's a spectrum. Those who stay with that older, you don't go, it's super sacred, it's mysterious, you have grills and locks, and the nuns never see you face to face. There's sometimes a black curtain at the entrance. And you have other monasteries that are saying, this is useful. This is evident. It is useful for us to go to a workshop on the teachings of St. Bonaventure. But we will get permission from the bishop, and we will go to the workshop. So they don't just fly around. First of all, they can't afford to. But clerics today in certain monasteries will exercise a kind of prudent judgment of things that they can do to keep their lives healthy and on track. So Claire gave a lot more leeway and credit to the judgment of her successors, right?
What do you think we can learn today about her own approach, critique, respect, the whole, you know, everything that Claire embodied with authority? What can we learn from Clarion leadership today? What could that look like? How could it help bring healing today?
For me, the biggest lesson in her lifetime of interactions with authorities, whether it was priors or church leaders, is that she valued the primacy of being in relationship as a Christian sister to these brothers. So it begins with the earliest brothers. She's the first woman. But the rapport, and of course, you can tell from the legislation of the times, and it's not something we should sniff at. It was probably pretty prudent that there's a lot of effort to make sure that if you've got a group of women attached to an order or a movement led by men, you've got to have some boundary lines clearly marked out. And so she begins in this awkward position of there aren't other women. They don't have a monastery and a convent waiting. So she is immediately taken to live with Benedictines. She doesn't stay there very long. She then goes on to stay with a group of penitent women living up on a hillside outside of Assisi. There again, they're not being led by the friars or tutored by the friars, but she's learning what are the structures. She takes from the Benedictines a lot of wisdom. You know, the chapter where every sister, whether she's just come in a day ago or she's been there for 80 years, speaks, where work is assigned, you know, so everybody knows, oh, you've got the kitchen, I get the latrines, you know, but we'll switch next week. You know, that sort of thing. So I think that she learned from these different experiences how to negotiate what to accept and what not to accept. And I think that she also, because of that primacy of relationship, she tries to conduct her disagreements in a way that they don't end in bitterness. It's not win-lose. It's, can we keep finding a way? I think that's an underlying theme, because we don't see the church authorities invoking negative sanctions against her, as you would against someone who is simply being, you know, resistant and disobedient and disruptive. No, she's valued. So they want her to do well. And I think the fact that she always manages to get that eye of the needle threaded as a sign that they do respect and have a certain affection, even if at times it's grudging.
So I wanted to take some time with something Sister Margaret just said about this animating force, really, to St. Clair's approach to leadership. And the phrase Sister Margaret used was primacy of relationship. It made me think back to my first full-time job, one of my first full-time jobs. And this was in sports information at Grace College in Winona Lake, Indiana, my alma mater. And I had a wonderful boss and athletic director named Chad Briscoe. And he would emphasize something similar, that everything we did as an athletic department had to be about serving others and building relationships. So whether that was writing a game story or improving the website or doing radio for a game, it was never about what we were doing. And we were doing some innovative things in sports information at that time. But it was about the service that we could provide. It was about the parents on the other side of the country now being able to tune into the radio stream to hear the game their child was playing in, or the student athlete who had worked hard in their sport and had earned an accolade or an award. And now we were able to celebrate them via storytelling and media to help that person to feel special and seen. And I have come back to this relational approach to work and to the world again and again throughout my life, in my work as a storyteller and editor, and as a high school golf coach as well. I know that there will be hard decisions, tough conversations, conflict, challenges. And I found that it's easy when that pressure is kind of turned up to internalize or get tunnel vision or become self-focused or even, I admit, self-absorbed. But I've learned that there's something really isolating and anxiety-inducing about this, about going into a silo. Of course, I want this podcast or the books I've written to be successful, whatever successful means, right? And yes, of course, I want the teams that I coach to experience the thrill of victory. But I have to remember that in this pursuit of Christ-like excellence, that was another phrase that Coach Briscoe used, that it is about service and helping others along the way. Or in the case of coaching, helping my players to learn about life's important values through the game of golf, just as Coach Briscoe helped us learn in sports information. So I'm reminded of the passage in Matthew 20, where we're told that Jesus came not to be served, but to serve. And I'm just curious, you know, what does primacy of relationship look like to you in your day-to-day life? And how might this kind of leadership take form in situations where there may be conflict or tension? And lastly, what do you find challenging or inspiring about primacy of relationship as an approach to life and leadership? So I invite you to reflect upon those questions. Maybe hit pause on whatever service you're listening to this on. And then we can go back to the interview. Yeah, I like what you said there, the primacy of relationship, almost as her, would you say that that was her almost mode of being as a leader?
Yeah, and I think as a leader, it's not always easy. I mean, in your life as a leader, you're going to make many, many hard calls. One of the things that I think a good leader, and especially a good Franciscan leader, does is think as deeply as possible about how do I make that call and still have a relationship. And let's say the call is, I'm telling the person your job is over. Thank you for your service, but this is not working out. Can I do that in such a way that I can bump into that person in the grocery store a month from now and we say, hello, glad to see you. How are you doing? Doesn't always work out because the other person has to have some of that reciprocity. I also think sometimes you have to be willing to switch channels as a leader of when am I sitting in my leader chair with this person and when am I entering into the community. So example would be college president. The faculty senate has just voted down something I think is really important. I'm mad as hops. The senate president comes in. I say, you know, come on. You know that, well, yes, sister, but we couldn't get the most, you know, on and on. So we argue, and I say, I'm not done. I'm bringing it back. 30 minutes later, where am I? The reception for retiring faculty. So now I walk in, and I'm, hey, how, you know, congratulations. This is a lovely party. Congratulations to the retirees. So you learn, you know, I could stay away and show how mad I am. But if I show up, and this is not about our work on the legislation I proposed, this is about honoring our colleagues. What a great thing to be doing today. But that's not easy. And you don't always have the spiritual or psychic energy to do it.
Yeah, it takes a lot of humility, right? Yeah, to be able to, like some would describe it as compartmentalization, but I think it's way spiritually deeper than that, in the sense that like you're you're letting go. You have the humility to let go of your own agenda, this thing that didn't go the way you wanted it to go.
Absolutely.
And you dare to give of yourself to this primacy of relationship again.
That's right.
You know, like, let's lift others up. That's what today is about
yes.
Lifting others up.
And Stephen, it's in a time when people are very cynical about this sort of thing. Somebody said, what a phony. My God, she was just in there lambasting him. But, you know, it's like that's the risk you run. And I think if you are consistently trying to manage the leadership functions, which differ every hour. One moment you're called upon to be a decision maker, the next you're standing in a funeral home, the next you're at a meeting with, you know, all the presidents of your county. You have to keep moving with different speeds and with different sets of rules. So having some of that inner flexibility is a big gift. And you can learn it from others as well.
Yeah.
And it's sadly the thing that is lacking in American politics today.
Absolutely. And that brings me to my next question is, you know, sticking with Clarion leadership and the culture that she helped to facilitate at the San Damiano, the monastery there. I mean, it was very democratic in a lot of ways, correct? Where every
yes.
voice is heard, no matter your social status. And this,
right.
you know, we keep coming back to it, but this primacy of relationship, that's what was most important. Like status goes out, like, let me hear your voice. Talk about the culture she helped create there.
Right.
And what makes it unique, because would you say democratic is the right word?
I think we could say proto. Democratic. And we need to be careful because, of course, right now we live a very fraught version of that. But I would say she and Francis are part of a shift in consciousness in Europe, in Western Europe, about the difference between a hierarchical society where only the wealthy, the landed, the royal have prerogatives. And if you're at the bottom of that pyramid, you just hope to die in your bed and maybe get to purgatory. I mean, heaven was even considered a big stretch. So you had very little agency and no political power. What is happening is that is coming into question. And it's coming into question. A variety of forces are making that happen. But one of the things is the rising importance of trade and finance and commerce. And as certain men and some women start to specialize as bankers, as money lenders, as people who run a business, whether that business is the making of fine silks or brewing or leatherworks or ironworks, those persons start to achieve a status that is not based on where they were born or their family name. It's based on they provide a service without which we can't reorganize in this area. We need all of these services. And so, and then they learn from the Benedictines. I mean, this idea that you bring everybody together, you listen to everybody, even the youngest is very rash. It's very new. But the Benedictines have this wisdom that you may not get the decision you want right away, but you stay at it until there's been enough discussion, enough thought, enough prayer that eventually, 99% of the time, you will get harmony. And so I think we're not always very good about acknowledging how much we talk from our predecessors, the Benedictines, and brought it over into the Franciscan movement. But there's an enormous wisdom there. And, you know, the way that the Benedictines have survived longer than we have.
Yeah. Can you go deeper into that notion of listening to everybody as a core component of leadership or Clarion leadership in this context?
I think in Claire's case and in Francis in the beginning, listening to everybody wasn't hard. Everybody was right there. You rang the bell, everybody showed up, you talked. So in one sense, the call to give everybody a chance to be heard was also supported by size and architecture. What happens when now you have, let's say on the side of Francis, hundreds, thousands of men, men who have joined the Franciscan Brotherhood and never laid eyes on him? You have to start calling people together periodically with instructions. We will come together at Pentecost and we will meet down in Assisi and we will build little straw huts and we will gather there. So in Claire's case, it never changes. It's always just the women under the roof with her. Now, other monasteries are following her example, but they don't follow slavishly because they're different women in different places. So you have a diversity, even with the early Claire monasteries. And with Francis, the diversity arises because distance, different cultures, the needs of the friars change. The ones who are up in Germany are coming back and saying, we can't get through another German winter unless we can have sandals and socks and, a warmer blanket. So that the structuring to hear others. And I would say that, isn't it very interesting that just a few weeks ago, we were all just tied up in knots over will everyone who wants to vote, vote, and will their vote be counted? Unthinkable that we should even have a worry. Unthinkable that we should have a worry. But when that trust starts to erode, we really better set up. And let's take Claire and Francis as good models that you never give up on providing the space for that voice. It's critical.
That's beautiful. And I know we're coming up on the hour here. Anything I left out or anything else you would like to add, particularly as it pertains to what you just said about here's this moment that we're all in right now. There is this mistrust of institutions. There is, it feels like chaos a lot of times. However, if I'm hearing you correctly, I mean, I love the phrase you just used, that creating the structure to hear others.
Yes.
That's very difficult to do.
Stephen, it is. But what I would say is that I am very impressed by the fact that in these last few weeks, what has emerged, and you hear it in different media, are precisely what I just talked about, structures being created by people who want to hear each other across a great divide. And I think that may be one of the things we're called to do in the next decade, is to be very intentional about finding ways that we, especially those of us who carry the name Franciscan, is there a conversation circle? Is there a church group? Is there, Association of Women Vote, the League of Women Voters? Is there somewhere within reach of who I am, where I am, where I work, a place where people are working? Because you don't just come into a room and do this. You need skill. You need facilitation. You need a constant self-critique in order to catch yourself when you shut down when the other person starts, instead of keeping that door open. But there are people specializing in this work. And I think this is their hour and we need to look for them or help create them, mentor people who are willing. And we do have organizations at regional and national levels where I think we can plug in and say, we can't do everything, but, it's that whole notion of you think globally, but you act locally. And so trying in our own locales to find ways to have those conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite things about the Franciscan tradition is all throughout the stories of Francis, which of course goes back to how he was following Christ, like you said, but it's just radically affirming the other time and time again to the point where it becomes so uncomfortable. And you're like, I'm letting go of, you know, every preconceived notion I had here.
That's
I'm letting
right.
go of, like, Christ is in this person.
Yes.
And therefore there's something to learn, even if I vehemently disagree on the surface.
I have a cousin who belongs to a Methodist congregation that's doing a lot of work in this area, but we were talking about how they have dealt with the various exclusions that we experience, LGBTQ persons, excluding people of a certain, perhaps political persuasion, or in their case, you know, the kind of Christian nationalist evangelicals. And she said, our pastor says over and over, you will never meet a person for whom Jesus did not die. That stops me cold.
Yeah.
If I can look and say, oh my God, Jesus died for you as much as for me, I better shut up and listen, you know?
Yeah. Why does that move you so much? It's a really beautiful notion.
Because it flips the whole way of thinking about that other person to, what does Jesus think of this person? What does Jesus want? Of course, I think Jesus wants what I want. But if I can let go of that for a minute and just say, but I just met this person and Jesus has been loving him or her since birth and loving them through life. And so I better figure out how to show respect for that.
Yeah, it's such a powerful moment in the conversation, isn't it? And I would consider, you know, maybe pausing for a second and really think about what Sister Margaret just said. What rises up within you as you hold her words and focus your gaze upon them, as you consider her words, as you contemplate her words? I'd like to read this famous passage from Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander by Thomas Merton about his mystical moment at the corner of 4th and Walnut in downtown Louisville, where he felt mysteriously connected to all these passersby who he did not even know. And perhaps, whether you've heard this or not, maybe it can become new to both of us as we meditate upon this passage. And in meditating upon it, to allow Sister Margaret's words to plant themselves deeper than our own hearts. So Merton writes, and again, he's writing about all these people walking by him, all these people he's observing in the middle of this bustling downtown. And Merton says, then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. But this cannot be seen, only believed and understood by a peculiar gift. Merton goes on, at the center of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and by illusion. It's a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God in us. Merton continues, it is like a pure diamond, blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody. And if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere.
I think, Stephen, that one of the things that we don't have much opportunity to do today is to be in groups or settings, church, country, you know, ethnic group, although some ethnic groups and our Black Americans are doing a lot more of this, where we come together to celebrate what we hold together as sacred. And that is the reason we should go to the trouble of trying to be in the same room and trying to find a united way forward. And so I do think that we need those celebrations. I talked to friends who were at the Eucharistic Congress, for example, and they went not necessarily thinking it was going to be a real good time. As it turns out, they were the only religious women not wearing a habit. And that became the point of encounter. People coming up and saying, can I talk to you? What is it like for you? I mean, this is other religious in habit who've always assumed like, oh, shame on them. You know, they're not wearing a holy habit. And sister said to me, it was a real conversion experience because we care about the same things and we're expressing it differently, but we could talk it out together. And so those are the moments where they could have those conversations because there are 3 days in this center and walking back and forth and going to Eucharist together and to different devotions. But you have to be willing to cross over and place yourself there too.
Yeah. And it does remind me of some of Pope Francis's writings of, you know, this culture of encounter he's encouraging.
Yeah.
And I know that's big in Franciscanism.
Exactly.
Right. You know, like, be humble enough to enter into this encounter, as messy and chaotic as it may be.
Yes, yes.
And Claire did that. I mean,
she did. But I also think we want to be careful. There's a bit of a romanticizing of chaos theory in our times. And I'm talking about, you know, the chaos theory that comes from the sciences. And there was a lot of writing and talking about that about a decade ago among religious. And the truth of the matter is, this is a very tough time for religious congregations who are experiencing serious decline, trying to think through, but doing it and doing it with a lot of assistance and smarts, how to work through the next decade of existence. And yet it's very possible sometimes when people are feeling stressed and they don't have good answers, say, well, we've got to embrace the chaos. And I'm like, if I'm 90 years old and I just need to know I'll have a roof over my head and I'll get my medicines every day, don't tell me to love chaos. I need some assurances, you know, that of basic human safety, security. They're real primal questions we have to pay attention to.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up here toward the end, is that, you know, I mean, that primacy of relationship, that creating a structure to hear others, it almost contains, it almost either eliminates the chaos or contains it because you're affirming each other.
Right. Yeah, right. And I think, you know, there's a certain level of chaos in our society, in our world, in our church. You can't avoid it. And avoiding it leads to that kind of fundamentalism, like, you know, this is the only way. But I also think we can play with it in a way that is not helpful, especially to certain personalities who just become more defensive and withdrawn.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, this has been so great, Sister Margaret. I want to be respectful of your time. Can I ask you one more question and then let you go?
Okay. Why not?
So, I was just wondering, I mean, you're a world-renowned scholar on St. Clare, and what impact is she having on your life today at this spiritual part of your own journey? What impact is she having on you?
Well, one of the things is, you know, I've had a lot of health issues lately. And she, in her role as Francis and his, is so precise about caring for the sick. And you look back and you think, why did they spend so much ink on that? You know, I mean, yeah, somebody's sick, you do. Because in a big monastic setting, the care for the sick was assumed. There was a place the sick went. There was a brother or sister infirmarian. There was an herb garden. There was somebody who knew medicinal arts. But if your life is wandering, being on the road preaching no fixed abode, or in the case of the sisters, just this one little place with its little garden, and you become sick, what are our options? And both of them go to real trouble to say how the sick are to be cared for, that they're given things, extra things, whether it's clothing or food or help. And so I have experienced that. I've experienced that now for almost a decade of sisters who've been so generous to help meet my needs that I couldn't have met without their assistance. Really, really humbling. I would say the other is that I have had years of experience working with the different branches of the Franciscan Brothers. And I'm a little more distanced from that now that I'm no longer physically at St. Bonaventure. But it's really important for me to keep those relationships alive and to keep working together to be a model in the church of men and women who follow a shared path. So I think those would be two.
Yeah, well, you certainly are an incredible model of Franciscan spirituality, not only in your writing, but in how you live and lead the way in that regard. So,
but
thank you
catch
for your
me
time,
on
Sister
a good
Margaret.
Day, Stephen, every now and then. But thank you very much, Stephen. This was a great
Let's catch each other on a bad day. We'll really have some fun.
Oh, yes.
Well, thanks for coming on Off the Page, Sister Margaret.
Okay, good to be with you, Stephen. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
Once again, that was Sister Margaret Carney. Sister Margaret's biography on St. Clair, Light of Assisi, is available in print, ebook, and audiobook. And if you're interested in donating to our Rebuild God's Church initiative to help us create more content like this, you can visit franciscanmedia.org/rebuilding-gods-church. It's truly an honor and it's a joy to hopefully create content that accompanies you on your spiritual journey. So thank you for your support. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to Sister Margaret. And final thank you to Father Cyprian Concilio for providing the music for this episode. This is Stephen Copeland signing off. Peace and all good.